and withdrew a piece of paper, which he extended in our direction. "Here, Jill boy, read it for yourself." Jaime moved over and accepted the paper, which was obviously a warrant to enter and search the premises. The lieutenant turned to the black policeman at his side.
"Tell the black bastards they must all show their passbooks and a pass from their employer to stay out after 9 o'clock curfew."
I turned to the white policeman. "It isn't 9 o'clock yet, lieutenant. No one's broken curfew." He grinned.
"Yeah, I know, man. But it will be when I'm finished here, and any black bastard without a pass is arrested."
"This warrant is for St. John's College," Jaime said suddenly. "Look, see here, it says St. John's College, Houghton. That's the school about a mile down the road."
"Don't play silly buggers with me, you hear? Or you three will spend the night in a cell down at Central."
Jaime walked over to the white police officer.
"Read it for yourself. It says St. John's College, Houghton. That's not us. Now, will you kindly leave?"
"This is the right place. This is the place in the newspaper, I'm telling you, man. St. John's, that school, does it also teach covers?"
I could see he was suddenly confused. "You'll have to ask them that yourself, officer," I said, not trusting myself to look at Jaime. The police officer folded the warrant and put it back in his pocket.
"I should arrest you for obstructing the police in their duty. You know it's only a technical error, man. They got it wrong when they was looking on the map. This is the school, I'm telling you."
"That's not what it says on your piece of paper. I really must ask you to leave, officer," Jaime said, playing the situation for all it was worth.
"Okay, Jew boy. But don't think you've seen the last of me. I know a communist when I see one."
He pointed to me.
"You too, you and your Kaffir friend. I can smell a communist a mile off."
He left with his men, and we could hear their boots on the cobblestones as they crossed the school quad.
"Hurlimolensky, that was close," I said. "What happens now?"
Gideon grinned a lopsided sort of smile.
"I think it is finish. The school is finish."
"Not on your fucking life," Jaime said. "I'll get my old man's lawyers if they try doing that again."
Gideon gave a wry laugh.
"You will be safe, but we will go to jail. It is always like so. You are very clever, and the magic of the Onushobishobi Ngilosi is make the change for the school name on the paper. But the police, they are bad people. They will not give up so easy. But also, I think, the big boss for headmaster, he will make finish with this school."
"Over our dead bodies," Jaime said. "I'm telling you, he'll fight for the night school." But he didn't. The next Monday, the two of us were called to St. John Byrne's office to be confronted by an officer of the South African police force.
"This is Captain Swanepoel of the Johannesburg Central Police Station. He wishes to ask you a few questions," St. John Byrne said sternly. "It seems your report to me on the weekend doesn't quite respond with the one submitted by the police officer who attended your class on Saturday night. I urge you to tell the complete truth to Captain Swanepoel."
"We told you precisely what happened, sir," I said to the head.
"With respect, the officer in charge of the visit is trying to report correctly. You can take my word for that," the police captain said.
"Well then, in that case, there would be no difference in our versions, Captain Swanepoel. I mean, if we both told the truth," Jaime said softly.
"The truth? What is the truth? In my experience, the truth goes out the window when emotions come in. Emotions always tell a story different. You take my word for that, headmaster," Captain Swanepoel replied.
"Captain, both these boys have been trained to observe a situation with some dispassion, even though it be one in which they are involved."
"Yeah, I mean no disrespect, headmaster. But I must take the written evidence of an adult police officer against two young boys who were very excited at the time."
Perhaps Captain Swanepoel can tell us where our evidence differs, sir, I asked.
Why, yes, of course,
the head cleared his throat.
According to Captain Swanepoel, you did not cooperate with the officer in charge of the visit, and you were abusive in the extreme.
We were not given the opportunity to cooperate, sir. The officer was both abusive and bullying, and referred to me as a kafabuti, Levy as the Jew boy, and to Gideon Mandoma as a bloody stinking kaffir. I looked up to see the beginnings of a smirk on Captain Swanepoel's face.
That is not possible. A police officer of the South African police force is trained to be respectful to the public.
He turned to St. John Byrne.
People make things up all the time, things the police are supposed to say.
Are you calling us liars, Captain? I said. Swanepoel ignored my question.
It says here that you used abusive language to the officer in charge of the investigation.
Yes, I told him to piss off, Jaime said. But you have yet to answer Piquet's question, Captain.
I will answer it later, son, don't you worry about that,
Swanepoel shot back.
Is what you said not abusive language?
Levy was extremely provoked, and as the officer had no right to be on the premises, the remark was not unjustified, sir, I replied.
I didn't ask you, and he didn't answer my question.
He pointed his finger at Jaime.
I'm asking you again. Is what you said not abusive language?
Put like that, yes, but
no but, man. You admit you were abusive to the officer, then?
Admit I told him to piss off, Captain, Jaime replied.
Then we are in agreement. The first fact we challenge turns out to be correct. Why must I not believe this report is a correct statement of what happened?
I say, that's not fair rules of debate, Captain Swanepoel,
St. John Byrne demanded. Captain Swanepoel turned to face the headmaster.
I'm a police officer, not a schoolteacher. I look at the evidence. I do not play games.
We have 42 Africans, as well as our own chaps, who will confirm what we've said, I protested.
I'd heard the warders interrogate prisoners, and they would use the same technique as Swanepoel was now using on us.
Ah, yes, 42 hostile witnesses. Africans do not have the same idea about truth as a white man. As for the other white boys, we are reluctant to take evidence from juveniles.
You still haven't answered my question, Captain, Jaime said, his teeth clenched.
You know something, son? Sooner or later, your type of person comes before the police again. I will remember your face. Please answer our question, sir, Jaime shouted.
Swanepoel laughed.
When we meet again, I will answer it then, you hear?
What happens to this report, Captain Swanepoel?
St. John Byrne asked.
The police captain sighed.
Ah, because of the technical error in the search warrant, I must very reluctantly withdraw this report.
May I please have it, Captain Swanepoel? I asked. Swanepoel laughed again.
The South African police do not give souvenirs. If you want some souvenirs, go to the Easter show.
I'm delighted to hear that's the last of it. St. John Byrne said, obviously relieved.
No, headmaster, it is only the beginning. You can consider yourself very lucky we got the wrong school name on the search warrant, because today I have come here as a friend. If we come again next Saturday night and we find that this wonderful school you have here is teaching black communists, then we will be forced to make some very unfortunate conclusions.
I really do protest, sir.
St. John Byrne was now suddenly angry. Captain Swanepoel grinned.
These days it is not very hard to find a black communist.
He looked at Jaime.
Or even a white one.
Then at me.
Even more than one. When blacks want suddenly to have education, you can take it from me, they're up to no good. Somebody else or something else is behind it.
Are you telling us to close down the night school, Captain?
Headmaster, the law in this matter is not clear yet, but teaching black people in a white school will not be allowed in the new Group Areas Act. You can see my position, Headmaster. I must tell you also, my duty in this matter is very clear. Next time we will not make a mistake with the search warrant. And when we come, we will find something.
He paused and looked again at us.
We always find something.
He rose and extended his hand to St. John Byrne. The headmaster did not take it. Instead, he gripped the side of his desk and leant forward slightly.
We will not be intimidated by the police, Captain Swanepoel. We have not broken the law, and as far as I know, this is still a free and democratic country.
Captain Swanepoel shrugged and stooped down to retrieve his cap from the floor by his chair.
I'm sorry you will not cooperate with the police, sir.
He adjusted his cap, then turned back to face the headmaster, touching the peak lightly in a casual salute.
Good afternoon, sir.
Without a look at Jaime or me, he turned and left, closing the door quietly behind him.
Shit, what now? Jaime said under his breath.
What was that, Levy?
Nothing, sir.
The light from the window backlit St. John Byrne's snowy hair, and he looked frail as he continued to grip the desk, swaying slightly as though the motion kept him from disintegrating into a million tiny bits which would silently float away on the dusty beam of sunlight.
"Bravo, sir," Jaime said.
He shook his head slowly.
"We are beaten."
"But you just said..."
"Sure, bravado, my boy. We will have your school on Saturday, and Captain Swanepoel will officially raid the Prince of Wales School, after which the Board of Governors will meet, and their conclusion is foregone."
He looked up.
"Nevertheless, we will open next Saturday evening. A Pyrrhic victory, to be sure, but there is an important principle at stake."
We left the head's office on a thorough downer.
"Fuck the Pyrrhic victory, the principle, and the principal as well,"
Jaime exploded, once we were out of earshot. "To let Gideon and the other boxers know. It's only fair that they decide for themselves whether they'll come."
"Yeah, I suppose," Jaime said morosely. "What about the others?"
"Forget it, they won't come. Last Saturday was enough. There's no principal involved for them. Just another opportunity taken away, another door closed. They spend their lives being screwed by the system. Would you turn up if you knew you were almost certain to be arrested, thrown in jail, lose your job and be branded as a communist?"
"I'm beginning to realize how lucky I am to have a white skin."
Jaime was taking it worse than I was. "I'd been around this kind of intimidation all my life, and I knew Captain Swanepoel could have been a lot more difficult had he chosen to be."
"What are we going to do, PK?"
I laughed. "You really are a city slicker, aren't you? You still think the police are there to protect you from the big bad wolf. After Saturday night, this whole scenario was predictable. The Nationalists don't see it as a kindergarten for adult blacks. To them we are starting a black revolution in the heartland of white privilege."
"You can't be serious. Our dumb school for boxers and houseboys."
"From little acorns, mighty oak trees grow. The Nats are not stupid. You should know the Jews made that mistake before with the Nazis. They thought of them as a bunch of thugs whom they could buy off. Have you seen the educational qualifications the Nationalist government has for its cabinet? It's probably the best educated cabinet in the world. Racism does not diminish with brains. It's a disease, a sickness. It may incubate in ignorance, but it doesn't necessarily disappear with the gaining of wisdom."
"Are you telling me you knew all along this was going to happen?"
"No, of course not. I thought we had a chance. You were right to be somewhat cynical at the beginning, but it was worth a try."
"But just now in the head's office, you seemed so disappointed."
"Christ, Jaime, I'm not saying I wanted it to happen. I was angry and bitterly disappointed, disappointed that I was right."
"You're a complicated bastard, PK. I'm supposed to be the realist in this partnership. What do we do now?"
"Well, Saturday's out for a start. No point in putting the boxers at jeopardy, not for a Pyrrhic victory anyway."
"Well, at least we can teach them off to boxing."
"No way. That Swanepoel bastard will be watching us like a hawk."
"I feel so bloody helpless."
Jaime looked at me and shrugged.
"You know, before our visit to Sophiatown, I couldn't have given a damn. Yeah, sure, I'd probably have gone along with you on the school, like you've gone along with me on some of our scams. But after the fight, seeing those people, it's different somehow. and begin to have a concept of the people, of what it means to be oppressed, of what it must have meant to be a Jew in Hitler's Germany. It was the first time I'd seen Jaime confused. He'd come up against something that couldn't be resolved with money or influence. It was such a small thing they wanted, and we failed. I mean, those poor blighters wanted so badly to learn, just to read and write and do a few sums. It was the least we could do. Jaime was almost crying from rage. So that's what we're going to continue to do. I didn't spend 4 years with Gil Pete without learning how to beat the system. What do you mean, Piquet? Correspondence school. Miss Bornstein's correspondence school. Piquet, you're a genius. We've already got the whole course in 3 African languages, as well as Fanagalo. It's in the bag, old chap. We'll guinea pig the whole thing. We'll make it free for the class who have just been expelled. Then with Mr. Nguni's help, and for a small sum, yet to be determined, we'll sell a correspondence course for blacks throughout South Africa. We'll even send one to Captain Swanepoel and tell him to jam it up his arse so that every time he farts he sounds intelligent. Miss Bornstein's correspondence school would one day become the biggest of its kind in the Southern Hemisphere, with Miss Bornstein as actual principal. Mr. Nguni simply let it be known that the course came from the tadpole angel, who wanted the people to take pride in learning to read and write and do sums. It would turn out to be one of the more important elements in his financial and political empire in the years to come. 23. 1951 was the year I won the South African school's featherweight title, and the Prince of Wales School won the school's championship for the 3rd year running. Darby and Sarge were heroes, and both had become welcome members of the Master's Common Room. Success of any sort seems to break down social barriers. We all sat for our matriculation, although a first-class pass for St. John's people was a foregone conclusion. Atherton was selected for the South African schoolboy rugby team to tour Argentina, and Cunning Spider had made it into the Transvaal school's cricket team. Pissy Johnson, with a lot of coaching from Jaime and me, felt confident that he'd get the marks in his matric to study medicine. He'd become an expert at fixing cuts in the ring, and from this small beginning his ambition to be a doctor had blossomed. I had, by all accounts, a brilliant school career, getting my colours in rugby and 3 times for boxing, as well as being head prefect and a company commander in the school cadet corps. While my music hadn't really progressed, I was still by school standards considered amongst the more superior musicians. In St. John's terms, I was well on my way to being a Renaissance man. In my own terms, I felt less successful. I had survived the system, but that was in many ways the problem. I seemed to be losing control of my own life, forfeiting my individuality for the glittering prizes and the accolades of my peers. The need to win had become everything. The head had become more important than the heart. Hoppy's advice had worked too well. I had supported myself at school with the bank and the various scams Jaime and I had developed. But what had been intellectual amusement for Jaime was deadly serious for me. I needed the money not only to survive, but as a means of dignity. Jaime and I had become inseparable friends, and with the death of Doc, he was certainly the most important person in my life. But I knew deep down that Jaime had been chosen because he could help me survive the system. I was a user. It had become a habit, winner that I seemed to be. I had become a mental mendicant. I was conscious also of the price I paid, that in return, people took strength from me. Jaime, Miss Bornstein, Mrs. Boxall, all needed me as a focal point. I was required to perform for them in return for their unstinting help and love. The concept of the tadpole angel, which I had tried to set aside, would not leave me. After the Mandoma fight, the black crowds at my boxing matches had become enormous, and at the South African Schools Championships the police had been called to disperse the chanting crowd outside the Johannesburg drill hall. I knew that eventually something more was expected of me. All my life I'd been pushed around by the judge, by the lord, by the concept of the tadpole angel. In my own way I had fought, and in return had been given Doc and Hoppy and Gil Pete as my mentors. The point of all this was difficult to understand. Perhaps after all life is like this. But I felt that I needed to take one independent action,
that would put my life back under my own control. It was as though I needed to lose, but hadn't developed the mechanism to do so. I only had one problem with this. I hadn't any idea how to go about doing so. The only totally independent thing in my life was my ambition to become the welterweight champion of the world. It was the one thing that couldn't be manipulated. I either had it in me or I hadn't. It was the thing those who loved me, with the exception of Captain Smith and Gert, couldn't understand. It was the one thing in my life that seemed to make sense to me. In this single action, there was no corruption of the spirit. In the last week of term, St. John Byrne accompanied me to my interview with the Rhodes Scholarship Board. I had sat for two scholarships, one to Witwatersrand University and another to the University of Stellenbosch, an Afrikaans-speaking university with a brilliant law school. But more than anything, I wanted to go to Oxford. I felt I was unlikely to compromise this desire, come what may. Jaime's family had already agreed to pay for me to go, but even as a loan I found this unacceptable. Unacceptable to me, to the memory of Doc, to Mrs. Boxall, Miss Bornstein, Captain Smith, Gert, Hoppy Grunewald, Big Hetty, and most of all, to Giel Piet, who had never in his life experienced a hand extended to him in help. Even my mother, convinced that the temporal things of life were secondary, and who had given the Lord the entire credit for making my education possible, had sat behind a sewing machine from dawn until dusk to support me as much as she was able. I was a man now. I was through with taking. I felt the rest was up to me. If I didn't know what the next step in my life was to be, I felt that I might set it in motion by acting independently of the help that was always so generously extended to me by others. Jaime, the gambler and businessman, reckoned the odds on my winning one of three Rhodes scholarships for South Africa were less than even. As the time for my interview grew close, he grew more and more distraught. He sensed my need to act independently, and that to some large degree the Rhodes Scholarship would achieve this aim. At the same time, he wanted to cushion me from the disappointment if I lost. It was not unknown, but highly unusual, to be awarded a Rhodes Scholarship straight from school. Rhodes Scholars were almost always chosen after an initial degree at university, when the student had already confirmed a brilliant school career with an equally brilliant first degree, taken in conjunction with a sporting and cultural contribution in the university environment.
"Christ, P.K., in my old man's terms, the fees to Oxford are petty cash. We'd be together like always, and come back home and eventually open a practice together. You can start looking after the people, and I'll make us a squillion dollars. It's all so easy. Why do you have to make it so bloody difficult?"
"Well, for a start, I'm going to be welterweight champion of the world. If I took your dad's money, I'd have to use all my time to justify it at university."
"You don't have to justify it. You can do both," Jaime yelled.
"You know me better than that. Let me tell you something stupid, Jaime. If I had to choose between becoming welterweight champion of the world and taking a law degree at Oxford, the boxing would win." He looked stunned.
"Why? You're not the sort of guy who wants to be famous that way. In fact, you're exactly the opposite."
"It's got to do with something which happened when I was very young. I can't explain it. It's just got to be that way."
"P.K., the money you'll make as a professional, even a world champion, would be nothing compared to the two of us together in a law practice."
"It's not something I can explain. I've worked for this since I was six. It has nothing to do with the importance of being the welterweight champion of the world." I chuckled inwardly. How the hell could I explain to him that I was doing it in part for a dead chicken?
"Look, P.K., you're only just a lightweight. It will be 2, maybe 3 years before you become a welterweight. You can take your degree, or a good part of it anyway, and then go on with your boxing career. I'll help you. We'll even make a lot of dough out of it."
The interview with the selection board was a fairly harrowing experience. The first hour taken up with the board talking to St. John Byrne, while I cooled my heels in the waiting room of University House. The waiting was the worst part. The selection committee was comprised of three fairly elderly men who simply started to chat with me. One of them, a thin man with round steel-rimmed glasses which slid down to the tip of his very long nose, and whose hair was parted precisely in the middle and slicked down with brilliantine, looked like Ichabod Crane. He peered at me over the top of his glasses and quoted the first line of three verses from Ovid, then asked me to complete them.
I had to laugh. It was stuff I'd learned from Doc when I was 9.
Not bad. Not at all bad. Only one small mistake.
Please, sir, I disagree, I replied, my heart in my mouth. The three perms had been among Doc's favourites, and I knew them intimately. I was certain I had not made a mistake.
Bravo, young man, Ichabod said. You're quite correct. And besides, you had the courage to say so.
He pulled his glasses back to the top of his nose and wrote something down on a tablet of lined bright yellow paper. The three examiners looked positively musty with learning and not at all like sporting types. But after they'd chatted to me seemingly about this and that, they fixed on my boxing. Why, they wanted to know, was I obsessed with boxing? My submission showed me to be a brilliant student, a very talented musician, a good rugby player, and a brilliant boxer. One of them read from the submission, "Has the ambition to become a professional boxer and to win the welterweight championship of the world." I could see he was quite taken aback.
"Surely a boy of your obvious intelligence, or according to your headmaster, brilliance, must see that a vocation as a professional pugilist is not compatible with reading law at Oxford."
"Lord Byron was a pugilist, sir. No one doubted his intellectual integrity," I answered. He grunted and wrote something down on the pad in front of him. Ichabod Crane had a slight smile on his face.
"Ah, I do not recall whether Byron was an Oxford man," he said, which caused his two colleagues to laugh. "Your point is well made, Mr. P.K., but as I recall, he was an amateur."
"There is considerable evidence that he fought on occasions for a wager, which today would make him a professional, sir."
"Be that as it may, a small wager on the side amongst friends is hardly the same thing, is it?"
"No, sir," I replied, unwilling to press my luck any further by pointing out that quite large sums of money were involved. At the end of the interview, I was asked to wait with St. John Byrne in the waiting room. The head seemed even more nervous than me, and made me repeat every word of the interview. When I got to the bit about Byron, he was delighted.
"Excellent," he said, clapping his hands.
But then, when I told him about Byron fighting for a wager, and the somewhat brusque reply I had received, he frowned.
"That's Lewis of Natal University, a man who doesn't care to be contradicted."
When I concluded my account, he simply said,
"Well done, P.K. You have acquitted yourself well."
We were then ushered back in, and it was Ichabod Crane who announced that I had been listed in the last 5 candidates and would be required to sit for the Oxford University entrance examinations.
"The Prince of Wales School, which you attend, has an enviable reputation, and if you are an example of its product, the least I can say for myself and my colleagues is that we have been impressed."
They then stood up and shook hands with us both. St. John Byrne was elated. We were over the major hurdle. They had taken my schoolboy candidature seriously. Several days later, I sat with Jaime for the Oxford University entrance examinations, the results of which would be announced before the Rhodes Scholarships. I arrived home for the Christmas holidays to find my picture was on the front page of the Goldfields News. Mr. Hankin, frustrated newspaper man to the last, had used the picture Doc had taken of me sitting on our rock the first day we had met on the hill behind the rose garden. Despite the fact that everyone in town knew who I was, above it a banner headline read, "Boy on a Rock for Oxford." I recalled with a touch of bitterness the stupid old fart's last use of this picture on the front page, when he accused Doc of being a Nazi spy and of breaking my jaw. I found myself a local hero once again. As far as the town was concerned, my elevation to Rhodes Scholarship status was all over bar the shouting. In the month it took for the results of the Oxford entrance examinations to come through, Miss Bornstein became a nervous wreck. Down at the prison, they were much more impressed with Solly's 13-punch combination. If they could have chosen between a scholarship to Oxford, a place they'd never heard of anyway, or a 13 combo, there is little doubt they'd have plumped for the latter. Once again I won the Eastern Transvaal featherweight title, and also best boxer of the championship. With this, my 4th successive win, Captain Smut, in what he later described as one of the great moments of his life,
was able to claim the trophy permanently for the Barberton Blues. My examination results arrived in late January and stated that I had received a distinction in all subjects. Miss Bornstein was beside herself, and it was such big news around the place that old Mr. Bornstein contrived to lose the first ever game of chess to me, while denying hotly that he had purposely done so. 4 days later, a letter arrived from the Rhodes Scholarship Committee.
Dear Mr. P.K., on behalf of the Selection Committee for Rhodes Scholarships for the year 1951, we regret to inform you that your application has been unsuccessful. I have been asked by the Selection Committee to commend you for the manner in which you conducted yourself during your interview, and for the results you achieved in the required examination. It is the earnest opinion of the committee that having completed your first degree, you should apply again. Yours faithfully, L.J. Fisher, Secretary to the Committee. The people around me had become accustomed to my winning. It was a habit they shared, an indulgence they took for granted. I could see they were shocked and bitterly disappointed that having done their part, I had somehow failed them. Miss Bornstein and Mrs. Boxhall were distraught beyond belief, having quickly convinced themselves of some sort of plot. My mother, after shedding a few tears, soon concluded that the Lord had decided it was not his will for me, and that if only I would accept him into my heart and into my life, his purpose for me would become clear. 2 days later, she announced at the dinner table that the Lord had guided her quite clearly, and that I should give up boxing as it displeased him. When I had done so, I would be guided in the Lord's special plans for me. When I replied that boxing was too important to me, she had burst into sudden tears. "That is the devil in you talking! God is not mocked!" she shouted, leaving the table with her face buried in her table napkin.
"There, there. There's a good lad," my grandpa soothed.
The following day a letter arrived from St. John Byrne, in which he said he was confident I would ride through the disappointment, and that I had the internal fortitude to grow stronger from the experience. He added that the true Renaissance man accepted defeat as the ingredient which made eventual success worth striving for, blah, blah, blah. He then added that he had received a letter from Professor Stonehouse of Witwatersrand University, who, it turned out, was Ichabod Crane. In it, Stonehouse had remarked that the committee had been visited by Captain Swanepoel, who had not been complimentary about the school and its activities, and in particular my implication in these activities. He wanted to assure St. John Byrne that should he hear otherwise, this involvement by the police did not affect his judgment, nor did it, he felt sure, affect that of his colleagues. Stonehouse concluded by saying that my application for a scholarship to Witwatersrand had been accepted, and that he hoped the headmaster would be able to influence me to accept. The following week, the second scholarship to Stellenbosch was confirmed, and I received an invitation to apply to Natal University. But I knew in the minds of those who loved me that this would be accepting the crumbs from the rich man's table. They were emotionally involved with Oxford, and no other place, no matter how grand, would have satisfied their expectations for me, and rewarded them for the parts they had played. Only my grandpa seemed unconcerned. He'd said nothing when the letter from the committee had arrived, except, of course, "There's a good lad." I found him later in the garden grafting rose stock, and we sat out of the blazing December sun in the dark shade of one of the big old English oaks. As usual, he took 10 minutes to tap and tamp and strike and eventually puff up a blue haze around his head. I'd given him a tin of Erinmore, which I'd bought in Johannesburg, and the honey-treated tobacco smoke smelt delicious as it swirled around his head.
"My brother Arthur went to Oxford. He was the clever one in our family. Like you, he won scholarships. First to grammar school and then to Oxford."
He puffed and looked over the roof, which still hadn't been painted.
"In my time, not too many grammar school boys made it through to the dreaming spires of Oxford and Cambridge."
"What happened to him, Grandpa?" The old man puffed at his pipe and stared out into space for ages. Puff, puff, puff.
"I don't know what went wrong, lad.
He rose to be Lord Chief Justice of Appeal and was completely crippled by arthritis by the time he was 40. A miserable life, really. Made a lot of money and a lot of misery for himself and everyone else. According to my sister Jessie, he died rich and lonely. He puffed on his pipe a little longer. Funny thing about Arthur, he never could get things in their right perspective. Jaime had sent a telegram every week, demanding to know if the results had come out and asking me to phone him reverse charges when they did. I called him from Mrs. Boxall's office in the library.
Hard luck, PK. So close, so bloody close.
There was a click on the phone and then a woman's voice.
Operator here, please do not swear on the public telephone.
The phone clicked again.
Christ, who was that?
Jaime said on the other end. The phone clicked again and went dead. I dialed the exchange.
Operator, I was cut off. PK, this is Doris Engelbrecht.
Doris was a woman in her mid-twenties, a Marie tonsillectomy convert, who now taught Sunday school at the Apostolic Faith Mission.
I'm supposed to cut off calls that contain obscene language. Your party in Pretoria used filthy language and has taken the Lord's name in vain. I can't allow it on the public telephone, even if he is paying reverse charges.
I'm sorry, Doris. He just talks like that. He means no harm. It's just his way.
Ach, Sis PK, how can you know such a person? You who are so clever and all, and whose mother is a very high-up born-again Christian.
Doris, you're not supposed to be listening. Telephone calls are meant to be private.
It says in the book, I must not allow people to use obscene language on the telephone. How can I not allow them when I don't hear them?
There seemed to be no ready answer to this.
Doris, if you get me my party in Pretoria, I'll tell him not to use bad language. Tell him also to wash his mouth out with Lifebuoy soap, Doris said.
The phone rang a couple of minutes later. I grabbed it, and before Jaime could speak, said, Watch your mouth, Levy. Doris, the born-again Christian, is monitoring you. There was only the slightest pause on the phone.
What's your favourite chocolates, Doris?
Jaime asked. There was silence on the other end.
Black magic or one of those big £3 boxes with the picture of an English cottage on the outside showing all the flowers in the garden? You know, with the big pink ribbon?
The silence continued.
I just want to say I'm sorry for my language. Language like that can upset certain parties.
Doris's voice cut in sharply.
Tell the party on the other end I will not be tempted by the devil, PK.
Ach, man, Doris, my friend has a chocolate factory. It is just a way of saying sorry, I coaxed.
A box so big you can't pick it up with one hand, Doris,
Jaime said.
The box with the garden and the pink ribbon, then,
Doris piped in a small voice.
Okay, then you've got to promise not to listen any more, Doris, I said. Only if you promise on the Lord's name that your friend won't swear some more, she said, a trace of warning still in her voice.
Thanks, Doris, we both said. The phone clicked, and Doris was gone.
For Christ's sake, don't forget to send the chocolates, Jaime. I've got to live in this town.
Is it safe to talk now? Jaime said.
Of course, you have the word of a born-again Christian. No, I won't forget. We keep a room full of obscenely large boxes of chocolates at the carpet emporium. My dad calls them his sweeteners. Every customer gets a box when a salesman determines it's time to close the sale. My dad claims his entire carpet empire is built on chocolate.
Jaime laughed.
He even calls the salesmen his chocolate soldiers.
His voice changed abruptly. The offer still stands, old mate. You don't have to take the money, it's just a loan. Now that you've passed the Oxford entrance examination and all.
Jaime, we've been through that. You promised you wouldn't bring it up again.
Cripes, PK, what are you going to do? I told him about the 3 scholarships I'd been offered, and the paragraph in the letter which encouraged me to apply again when I had obtained my first degree. Jaime was silent for a moment.
Got it. We'll go together to whatever university you choose, and then we'll take the last 2 years at Oxford. You're only just 17, and I'm just 18. We've got lots of time.
It was my turn to be silent. You've forgotten one thing, I said finally. Jaime was quick as a flash.
Of course. course I haven't. We'll go to Witwatersrand and Solly can continue to train you and the old combo will stay together.
It sounds great, Jaime, but you've already been accepted for Oxford. This doesn't fit in at all with your plans.
Plans! Plans are meant to be broken. This is a much better idea.
But I knew it wasn't.
Let me think, Jaime. I just need a few days to think things out.
I knew quite suddenly that I would have to visit the Crystal Cave of Africa, that I had to speak with Doc. Doc was still a very real part of my life, and I had come to think of the Crystal Cave of Africa as the place I would be closest to him.
Call me, reverse charge, in a week. You promise now. So long, PK.
The next morning I packed a rucksack and left before dawn for the cave. By mid-morning I had climbed to the shelf next to the cave. I had no desire to enter. Doc's spirit was everywhere. I was as close as I needed to be. The shelf faced west and caught the late afternoon sun so that now I sat in shadow, the smooth dolomite surface still cold from the night. I closed my eyes as Nkosi Nkosikazi had shown me how to do so many years ago. Now there came the sudden roar of water in my head, and then I saw the three waterfalls. I was standing again in the moonlight on an outcrop of rock directly above the falling water. Far below me the river rushed, tumbling into a narrow gorge. Just before the river entered the gorge, an apron of green water spread from the base of the last of the falls, and across its center, a small boy's jump separating them, with the 10 black stepping stones, their smooth wet surfaces only inches above the swirling current. I took a deep breath and launched myself from the rock. The cool air mixed with spray rushed past my face. I hit the pool at the bottom of the first waterfall. The sound of the splash drowned in the roar of the water. I surfaced to be swept over the second of the falls, and then again over the third, landing in the deep pool of swirling green water. I fought my way to the surface and struck out towards the first of the black stones. Pulling myself up onto it, I hurriedly jumped from one stone to another, finally leaping for the pebbly beach beyond. I felt my toes and the ball of my foot touch the smooth round river pebbles, and as I landed, I found myself inside the Crystal Cave of Africa. The cave was illuminated as though by soft sunlight, and I had no trouble seeing around me. It was more magnificent than I had ever imagined. The stalactites suspended in every imaginable color, some hanging 30 feet from the ceiling. I walked towards Doc's platform, skirting the mirror-still pools of water, reflecting the grotesque and beautiful stone icicles. A ray of sunlight, as sharply defined as if it were painted in a Raphael skyscape, fell onto the platform. I looked up to see a perfectly round hole in the ceiling, through which the sun shone as though predestined for this precise hour of this precise day. The beam of light shone through the crystalline structures above the platform and spilt down the steps leading up to it. Slowly I climbed the rough natural steps until finally, standing on the top step, I looked down onto the platform where Doc lay at my feet. Doc lay as I had imagined he would, fingers extended, arms bent at the elbows and crossed at the wrists across his breast, his legs straight like the effigy of a medieval knight at rest on a Gothic tomb in a quiet corner of a great cathedral. He was made of pure crystal, the soft sunlight reflected from the effigy dancing at the edges. Doc's sculptured face was surrounded by burnished light. I told him of my fear of losing control of my destiny. How, because I had camouflaged myself so well, I seemed now to be shaped and directed too much by the needs of others. How the power of one within me was being dissipated, even though their purposes for me were not corrupt or ill-intentioned. On the contrary, their deeds came swaddled in the innocence of love. I was becoming powerless, as those around me plundered my spirit with the gift of themselves. It was as though there was a voice inside me explaining me to myself. I had become an expert at camouflage. My precocity allowed me, chameleon-like, to be to each what they required me to be, to Doc a companion, to Mrs. Boxall an enchantment, to the people, a champion, to Captain Smith, a fulfillment, to Miss Bornstein, a bright lint in a dull warp, to Jaime, a foil, to St. John Byrne, a product, and to my peers, an idealized schoolboy, a winner and a great guy. I was a poor boy among rich ones, and in my mind the status they gained by the simple expedient of being wealthy was only leavened by my superior performance in every other expectation. I had come to identify with my camouflage to the point where the masquerade became more important than the truth. While this posturing was so finely tuned, it was no longer deliberate. It had nevertheless been born out of a compulsion to hide. As a small child, I had discovered that only two places are available to those who wish to remain concealed. The choices are to be a non-entity or an exception. You either disappear into a plebeian background or move forward to where most others fear to follow. My camouflage, begun so many years before under the persecution of the judge, was now threatening to become the complete man. It was time to slough the mottled and cunningly contrived outer skin, to emerge as myself, to face the risk of exposure, to regain the power of one. I had reached the point where to find myself was essential. I was not conscious of how long I had been sitting cross-legged on the shelf, but slowly my eyes focused, and the soft blur of blue in front of them sharpened into the mountains to the west. In the rainforest below me, I heard the cry of a red luri. My legs were stiff, and my ankles sore where they had been crossed. I felt an overwhelming sense of freedom. The same sense of being free that I had felt when the big black hissing train had pulled out of the platform, away from the hostel, the fro and the judge. When Hoppy had sat opposite me and we had first shared an adventure and a green sucker between us. I had come back from the dream time in the crystal cave of Africa, with the certainty that I would be tested once more before the power of one would become mine alone, when my destiny would be in my own hands. I continued to sit completely still, as Doc had taught me to do, when observing any living thing.
Still like rock, Piquet. Past the itch and scratch and the pain, where the concentration sees with a diamond-sharp light.
And so I sat perfectly still, emerging slowly from the cocoon of the trance I had been in. In my mind, I asked Doc for a sign. At that moment, sitting still as a rock on the shelf directly outside the crystal cave of Africa, I had no doubts, nor was I troubled by the intellectual absurdity of the request for a sign, a confirmation in a physical sense of the message I felt so clearly within me. At first it was hardly a movement at all, even less than the flicker of an eyelid, a slight blurring of light. Then the head of the black mamba rose above the edge of the shelf, 2 feet from where I sat. Its flat anthracite head froze inches above the shelf. Its forked tongue, as though possessing a life of its own, flicked and trembled the air for vibrations. The huge snake rose, periscoping above the shelf, moving forward until its head was no more than 6 inches from my face. I could see its eyes, black tektites without movement, set above jaws of injected death. Its head moved in slow motion from side to side, sweeping across my sightline. If it struck, I would have 15 minutes to live. Enough time to enter the cave and lie beside Doc before my nervous system collapsed. The mamba's head moved below my line of sight, and then came to rest on the toe of my boot. I could feel the pressure of its body as it slid over the boot and along the shelf to disappear over the cliff's far edge. The snake could only have come out of the cave. Doc had sent me a sign. I knew what I was required to do. Slowly the numbness left my body, and I felt the rush of adrenaline as it hit my bloodstream, leaving me trembling. I waited until the shaking had ceased before I dropped down to the tiny ledge and worked my body flat against the cliff wall until I stood facing into the opening to the cave. The floor of the tunnel leading to the cave was covered with sand, worn from the walls by the erosion of the wind. I could clearly see where the snake had entered,
and then returned, no doubt having fed on the hapless bats asleep inside. Doc had sent me the sign I wanted. I carefully worked my way back to the ledge, shouldered my small rucksack, and started to climb down the cliff. The snake was unlikely to be on my path. Fat from eating bats, it would find a place to sleep under the safety of a rock, where it was unlikely to be disturbed. Once I'd recovered from my fear, I found the snake an entirely appropriate, even perhaps a magnificent symbol. The black mamba, the most deadly snake in the world, takes one partner for life. If its partner is killed, the second snake will often wait for the killer to return, prepared to die in order to take revenge. Not naturally aggressive, it will nevertheless defend its young, raising itself onto the last few inches of its tail and striking sideways in a whipping action. As most humans instinctively raise their arms in panic to defend their eyes, the mamba fangs most often strike into the top of the upper arm. The journey to the heart is swift, and the outcome deadly certain. There was a great deal of consternation from everyone concerned when I announced that I wanted to take a year off between school and university, and that I would go up to northern Rhodesia to work in the copper mines. It was as though all who loved me, even the boxers, felt that if I broke the continuity of my life, the spell which bound our relationship would be broken. Gert's brother had visited him at Christmas from the Copper Belt, and had talked of the shortage of white labor in the mines of both the Copper Belt and the Congo. The Korean War had just started, and copper prices had soared. He told of diamond drillers making £200 a week, and young grizzly men making £100 after they were paid their copper bonus. Northern Rhodesia was a British colony across the Zambezi. It was far away from the people who held me so dearly within the thrall of their ambitions. It was away from the legend of the tadpole angel. It was even away from boxing. I saw it as an opportunity to come to terms with myself, and to build my body to the size of a welterweight. The hard underground work would toughen me, while 12 months away from the ring would do me no harm. I had been boxing since I was 7 years old, and had fought 116 amateur fights. My instincts, which always served me well, told me it was time for a rest. Gert's brother, Dani, worked as a diamond driller, the elite corps among the Copperbelt miners. Most of the diamond drillers were Afrikaners from Johannesburg, attracted by the huge copper bonus white mine workers were being paid. They were so named because the cutting edge of the drill bits were studded with industrial quality diamonds to make them hard enough to cut through the rock. Dani worked in a mine near Ndar, in the center of the Copperbelt. He said he could get me a job as a grizzly man at the Roan Antelope Mine owned by Anglo-American in the small mining town of Luanshire. A grizzly man worked with high explosives and was the next highest paid job on the mine. The 4-day trip by train left South Africa at Beitbridge and travelled across southern Rhodesia to Victoria Falls, where I crossed the Zambezi into northern Rhodesia. Southern Rhodesia is not unlike the eastern and northern Transvaal, but across the great Zambezi the country changes to flat grassland and equatorial forest. The trees which covered vast areas of the country were unlike any I had seen before, for they carried their autumnal colouring all through summer. Leaves of brilliant reds and yellows and even mauves and purple, all the colours expected of a northern hemisphere autumn. A passenger who sat beside me told me of giant edible mushrooms that appeared in the forest overnight and grow 2 feet tall with a canopy 3 feet across. A mushroom weighing 30 pounds. I'd been around long enough not to take everything I heard as a gospel, but in the months to come I would see Africans selling these huge mushrooms at the side of the road, simply cutting off the amount the purchaser required. Giant, brilliantly coloured moths with a wingspan 10 inches across also bred on the wet, leafy floor of the forest. Northern Rhodesia felt different. The Africans, like most from Central Africa, were truly black, their faces seemingly flatter, and their build smaller than the lighter milk-chocolate brown of the Zulu or the Shangaan. They spoke Swahili, and it was with some consternation that I realized it was a language I did not speak, and that I was cut off from the African people for the first time in my life.
In the mines, they talked a language known as Kiswahili, which was not unlike Fanagalore, but like all languages designed for a working purpose, it was limited and stunted. Africans raw from their villages in the bush were recruited to the mines, where they were taught this mine language so that they could take instructions from their white bosses, and in many cases talk to each other. A work gang often contained black miners from half a dozen different tribes, each with a different language. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the fourth day, we finally pulled into the sleepy town of Ndola. Ndola was really only a small community made up of miners' families and tradespeople who lived off the giant copper mines. The remainder of the town's people were British Colonial Service Administration officers and their families. It made for an uneasy white dichotomy. The mining families seldom mixed socially with the civil service families, established at a separate end of the town. Ndola was 30 miles or so from Luanshire, but the end of the railroad as far as passenger trains were concerned. Gert's brother met me at the station, where the air was filled with the babble of confused and frightened blacks. White mine officers feigned indifference, while blue-uniformed black mine policemen, filled with self-importance and professional impatience, herded and pushed hundreds of Africans from the train. Too late now to turn back. They had been harvested from the bush like wild tatsama melons. For the past 2 days and nights, the train had stopped at small sidings with no more than a tin shed and a small clearing to separate them from the rest of the bush. Here small groups of perhaps a dozen Africans, wrapped in blankets, would be herded onto the train by a black recruiting officer. The whites of their eyes showed their fear and confusion as they were bundled aboard the hissing, steam-belching monster, jeered at by those who had earlier been gathered up, and who were by now, with arms resting casually on the sills of carriage windows, accustomed to the clickety-clack of momentum, and the wonderment of the snake which runs on an iron road. Now they were almost at the end of their journey. I watched as the black mine police tried to get them roughly into line. They came only because drought and a great locust plague had destroyed their crops, and the grazing for their cattle. Driven from their villages as indentured labor for the mines, they would work for a year so they could send money to keep their starving women and children alive. The fear these poor creatures felt the first time they were plummeted into the bowels of the earth was a source of great mirth to the initiated black miners, as well as to many of the whites. Gert's brother noticed me looking at the poor buggers.
"Ach, man, they're like a monkey when they first come. They can't even climb a ladder, and when you show them a mirror, they go almost white when they see the big ape looking back at them. It's very funny, man, I'm telling you."
He picked up my suitcase, and I followed him over to a green Bedford utility.
"I just come off shift, so I'll drive you to Luanshire. I telephoned the mess there yesterday, and I know you're coming. Tomorrow you got to report to the mine recruiting office for a medical, and then you go sign on for the School of Mines for 3 months. I got to warn you, man. They got a Welsh bastard there called Thomas. Watch out for him. If you get out of the School of Mines and get your blasting license, you go on to Grizzlies for 6 months. 3, if you're lucky. But the money is good."
"Why only 6 months or even 3? I asked as we pulled out of the station.
"Oh, I didn't want to tell you before, but if you're on Grizzlies much longer, the odds is cut down."
"The odds?"
"Yeah, man. The odds of getting badly injured or killed."
Gert laughed.
"They don't pay you that kind of money for nothing, you know."
"Does everyone go into Grizzlies?"
"Yeah, all the young guys. If you're over 22, your reaction's not fast enough. Only young guys are fast enough, or," he grinned, "mad enough to do it."
"Christ, it doesn't look as though I've got a lot of choice." Gert's brother laughed again.
"None. All young guys got to be Grizzly men. Nobody else will do it. On the run, it's not even allowed. Moving all through a grizzly is the best way, but it's also the most dangerous. The miners' union on the run won't have a bar of it, and grizzlies are banned anywhere in South Africa. But here, in northern Rhodesia, they don't care, man. As long as they get the muck out, they're happy."
He paused as he made a turn, heading the ute onto a corrugated dirt road leading out of town.
"But you make bloody good money, and if you're careful, you'll be all right."
I laughed.
"Don't worry, Danny. I'll be bloody careful."
He looked at me, his hands vibrating on the steering wheel
as we hit a particularly badly rutted strip. "That's the bloody trouble. A grizzly man comes on night shift, 11 to 7. He got the job to pull all the ore out of a stope. That's my job as a diamond driller.